Ladies and gents, we have the amazing Derek Hodge with us here. Derek, thank you so much for coming. Look,
greeting, man.
That is a bass player. That's a bass player's handshake. Now, if you've been sleeping in a cave or, you know, you haven't heard of Derek, he is just a fan. I've been geeking out on your bass playing for so long. Them old videos, I think, I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of days ago. We were sending the old videos of you, Chris Dave and Robert Glasper. Do you know, like, I don't know where that was actually way back in the day. You're sat on top
that
of an
had
amp
to be on,
on YouTube. Where did you, where was that?
No telling. No. There's no telling. I mean, if it looked like a small club or something, that was probably New York.
No, it was in the middle of the day. It was like some sort of like music workshop in the middle of the daytime. It looked like a classroom somewhere.
Oh, shoot. Maybe Chris Dave's event? Okay, Chris had a... So back then, like, it wasn't anything official, man. Chris used to come crash at Robert's place in New York. And when I would play in the city or had some studio work, sometimes I would crash at Rob's place. And, that was just the spot, man. So it was like when we happened to be there together, sometimes cats would just do different things. That's how the first experiment, us getting together, even happened. A random gig at 55 Bar. So Chris would get something and like we would just invite. I didn't really have any really gigs back then under my name, you know, but Chris was starting to get some calls too. So when he'd have something, we would play. Rob had something, you know, we would just play. Just that type of thing. So it was kind of nondescript, but the sound and the spirit was just all kind of this experiment hybrid type thing, man.
And how old were you?
Man, that's going back to, I can tell you exactly, I was 24.
You were 24, so like early 20s.
I remember, man, because that's how me and Rob kind of connected. He was big fans of Mogu Miller, you know, and he would always show up at the clubs. And anytime I played with Gru, and then I ended up making good friends with him and, you know, hanging out at his place, and man, that's really how to experiment.
And then it just spiraled into what it was, or what it is, you know. Yeah. I'm going to give people the lowdown, okay? And I've fact-checked this, guys, so it's we're all in, right? So you're originally from Philadelphia.
If it's a lie, you know what? We'll go with it.
It's true now. Right. You're originally from Philadelphia and started out on guitar before switching to bass. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who you know, where did that switch from guitar to bass come in?
Man, well, I can tell you exactly, man. I'm originally from Philadelphia, and my mother sang on the choir in West Philly, this popular church, Beulah Baptist, and it was an incredible church. She was on the choir with Patti LaBelle.
Come from a musical family.
Well, that environment, because she sang on the church choir with them, so it was just a really musical church, and the bass player there, Joel Ruffin, I'll never forget. I mean, I just wanted to be just like him. You know, my mom would sit me down on the church pew, and I was like, I would just focus on him when he played, and I said, I want to be like him.
Yeah.
And so we ended up picking up the instrument through the school system, you know, when I got in the first grade, and the bass was too big for my body, so they started
me on... why you on guitar?
Started me on guitar, and went from there. A couple of years later, they switched me over to bass, but man, I'm telling you, like, even I feel like I lucked out by even starting on guitar, because it just influenced decision making, you know, especially when you're on an instrument that has an obvious harmonic range, you know, guitar with bass, you know, you kind of get to it and explore it to try to make it sing a certain way in terms of the whole harmonic spectrum.
Yeah.
But guitar, you know, it's just right there in terms of a familiar range of tune.
You can play the chords and hear them all, and sometimes it's a little abstract on bass, isn't it?
Yeah, man. And the cool thing about that is that when I switched to bass, I also ended up playing in the little junior orchestra from really young. So I'm a guitarist switching to bass, but not all of a sudden playing school band songs. All of a sudden I'm in the orchestra playing with all these, you know, string players. So I'm hearing all this harmony every day.
And is this upright as well?
No, I'm playing the...
So you're playing... play upright, don't you?
I'm playing a Pearl Blue Junior Fender, a small-scale Fender electric bass the orchestra. But because, you know, I kind of acquired a taste for harmony, you know, really young, I think that made my ears just really open up even then, like, to really take in all that sound and, like, how the orchestra sounded.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know,
and
I wanted to kind of practice that. You know, when we were done, I was like, what are they playing? And I'd work out the little chords even then.
And who were you listening to? Who were your influences back then, before you went to music school?
Man, well, before school, well, early on, man, it was Joel Ruffin, and then I was heavily influenced by gospel bass players. I kind of learned later who they were.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I'd been listening. I didn't know I was influenced by Joel Smith until actually recently, where I found out he was on some of those records, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Andrew Goucher, of course. And actually, my first professional gig, people don't really know, was with James Moore.
Oh, really?
To James Moore, I was 12 years old, man.
You were 12?
That was my first gig. And because all I did back then, man, also, man, I loved the specific style of playing, man. I slapped a whole lot and tapped, and that was just the, yeah, man.
What you did, isn't it, when you...
Man, no, I love it. That, you know, that was where I'm from. So the cool thing about playing that music and really getting a chance to, you know, be floored by the influence of Goucher that young, you know, it was incredible. And I'll never forget, later in one night, I ended up hearing three bass players all on one cassette. My best friend, Thaddeus Trebet.
Yeah.
His older, I think his godbrother, or older cause I can't remember, but he's a well-known gospel artist, Jason Nelson.
Yeah, yeah.
But Jason's a bass player. And he's a guy that, you know, Terry looked up to, and I looked up to him. And I remember I was like 13, and Jason stopped by the house. And we were in his car, and we listened. He introduced us to three bass players on a cassette one night. That was the first night I heard Jaco.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Marcus Miller.
Wow.
And John Petitucci.
Whoa.
All in one night. And that,
I don't know if I could have taken that.
Man. And then that changed everything.
Yeah.
You know, that changed. I mean, it also changed. All of a sudden, you just realize a focus, because you fortunately, I had, you know, my best friend. We would just play together a lot. So, you know, we shared it a lot, but then that changed the focus, where we were all of a sudden trying to transcribe, you know, and getting night vision. And Marcus Miller, I think Tales had just come out at that time.
Yeah.
And at that time, John Petitucci was also doing things with that GRP big band, upright stuff with Chick, which was really cool, because at that point I'd switched to upright too in the orchestra. Yeah. So it was just divine timing. Like, the influences, when they hit me in my life young, it was just like,
Was this before you actually went to music school? Yeah.
Oh, wait.
This is
junior high, elementary. Yeah, elementary school with Goucher and Joel Smith, but then going into junior high with the influence of Marcus. And, you know, and it was an honor getting a chance. I did a panel with him earlier for a Blue Note Cruise, and to get a chance to tell him to his face.
Dude.
How much, you know, it meant a lot to be able to tell him that, you know.
Wow, so, amazing. Yeah. And was this around the time that, obviously, we mentioned that you're originally from Philadelphia, but you moved, didn't you?
Yeah.
Was that, you know, when you were hanging out with Thaddeus Trebet?
Yes, and I'm telling you, man, I'm from Philly, and I'm known for being from Philly. But I'll tell you, man, Willowboro, New Jersey, it's like little outskirts. It's like you drive through the whole town in 5 minutes, man. But it was a huge influence on me, because it was a hotbed of talent. Yeah. You know, that's how I met my best friend, Terry, and his older brother, Ty Trivet.
Yeah.
And then a few blocks over was another bass player, Wayne Moore, you know, who plays with Beck and a few other, NERD and all these guys.
Yeah.
And another great friend, Adam Blackstone, who is an incredible musician and music director for you name it.
Yeah, these are sort of like serious, like, you know, like legendary musicians. Yeah,
they're incredible. And to be quite honest with you, I feel like so much of my perspective and caring about the music, and also my way of getting along with others, is because there was no drama growing up as a kid. Like, we were each other. We were kind of on the outskirts, so we kind of had each other in this small town. The band room was the vibe. Sometimes playing together after school, before school, walking to school, listening to, you know, musicians. Like, that was the thing. And I'm telling you that, like, that really, I feel like a product of community more than anything. That's why I try to show them love whenever I can.
Absolutely. What do you think, gave birth to that hotbed of talent there? Was it a fluke? Was it just sort of like all the stars aligned? Or was there great roots in the generation below you guys?
It's kind of interesting, because there's a lot of African-Americans in Philly, and there's a lot of African-Americans in, you know, surrounding cities, Camden, New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey. And us all collectively, we're from one of those three cities.
Yeah.
And Willowboro, New Jersey, historically, you know, a lot of military, they gave incentives for African-Americans to actually own property and buy houses there. And that is what made people move out the city. They're, oh, man, we could be in a place, get out the, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what drove a lot of African-Americans families there. So it, yeah. Willingboro is this one pocket of a certain type of cultural influence and spirit. In the midst of you wouldn't know. It's like you're driving and there's literally cornfields everywhere. You know what I mean? A little better now, but at that time it was like, and then all of a sudden you go through Willingboro, New Jersey, and you go to that school, you'll feel a whole other energy. You know what I mean? And I think what kind of drew us all together was honestly just... we happen to all have those influence, but our families just, you know, finding a certain type of, hoping for a better life, or a different type of life.
And obviously we mentioned the bass players. Was there any other musicians that people might have heard of as well?
Yeah. In and around there? You know, when I was, you know, really young, an amazing, legendary musician, Juan Ye from Boyz II Men.
Oh, right, yeah.
Lived by Adam. So, you know, at that point, it was like a really... really like big atmosphere of like, oh man, we can really do this. That gave us hope, like, wow, we can do this and be the next.
Even though
we're playing bass, we could be the next or do something. You know, I went to school also with Ryan Tobey, who all of a sudden in high school, all of a sudden he ended up in the film Sister Act. They started a group City High, and then they went on from there to do great things. So all of a sudden there were, in Ty Tribbett, of course, Terry's brother, one of who was also I can't tell you enough of his influence just on music, you know. Yeah, Terry, I mean, don't underestimate those guys' influence. Ty had
crazy,
a big part to do with that thing of just fearlessness, you know.
Yeah.
Where you can do it all, you know, the music. There was never anybody around me saying, yo, Derek, you been in the orchestra while we all doing this? Man, that's corny. Nobody made me feel corny for being that guy, going to the library and wanting to study scores.
Yeah.
So I felt like, the world is yours, as Nas says, you know, and again, that's a product of mindset.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And you obviously mentioned studying scores there.
Yeah.
Because, and we'll get on to talking about you doing, working with symphonies and writing for symphonies, and like that, you are kind of unique in that way that, you know, you've like got your own thing going on and you're like a bass player and then that's a whole separate, like, part of your career, isn't it? That was that... Yeah. Did that start way back then as well, when you were a kid?
The desire for it started. Mm. You know, I remember I was a terrible reader, but the Philadelphia Public Library had just a mass of scores. And I would just go check them out. Didn't even know what I was really looking at to that extent yet. I would just go there and like literally just look at it.
Yeah.
Just look at it, you know. And when I tell you, that was honestly the beginning of it, because I... You know, again, going back to the guitar, when I started that at, like, I think I was 6, and that appreciation for harmony and being in the orchestra so young, I think that informed my decision-making, where that always was just a sound that I liked.
Yeah.
You know? At that point, I just did it for fun. I would just look at scores just for fun, not that I wanted to do this.
Yeah.
It was just something. So when I ended up going to Temple for music, I was a jazz major. And... you know, also with scholarship commitments, you have to be, you know, in the bands and for that. But I was really obsessed with the orchestra, so I would just start going.
So you were interested in it when you actually at music school
that,
as well?
When I got in music school, I'd never abandoned that desire. So I met the conductor of the Temple Symphony, and I started going to rehearsals, you know. They were tempted to even kick me out because I would just show up and just go, and I showed up to every rehearsal they had. I would show up and introduce myself to the different composer instructors and all that. I just made my presence felt.
Yeah.
To the point they actually opened up a space for me, and I ended up being the first jazz major ever in the orchestra
as well.
Chamber groups. But honestly, that was just will and not letting go of what I liked. You know, and I really feel like the career kind of found me in an honest way, because it seems like a cool plan now, but honestly, it was just never deciding to not feed what I actually enjoyed.
Yeah,
and I feel like a career kind of found me.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, when you went to music school, did your friends go to music school as well? Was there ever a conversation where you guys were like, what should we do? Are we going to music school? You know, are we going to do this?
Yeah, it's so funny. Not really, man. Because going back, you know, really young, I know it seems like this perfect plan, you know, growing up. But when you're in it and you're growing up so young, it's just hey, my friends play bass too. Yeah. You know? And that was the thing. Thaddeus Tribbett was so amazing, so young. He was already doing records and stuff at 16, 17, you know, years old. And he was already touring when I got into college. He and his brother, they were doing a lot of things already.
Yeah.
So when I got into school, and Adam Blackstone, he was a little younger, you know. So when I got into school, I was the first of that group that was doing going that path. And then Adam Blackstone later ended up going to University of the Arts right down the street from me. So we all kind of stayed connected in out of school. But another thing that was kind of cool was that idea of kind of two sets of notes. You know, I was always taking two sets of notes, you know, learning theory and study, but then being in Philly at the same time and us all re-meeting for gospel events or going to the Five Spot and checking out what James Poison Amir had going on. It was that thing, always balancing the real world with what's going on. And because we were able to all get on records early, you know, I think that was kind of the glue. It wasn't even our individual paths. It was that, you know, what are we all doing outside of our everyday? We would always get back together.
So. Yeah. If there's any music students watching this, and you want to give them like just one or two takeaways about they're going to music school, and you want to be like, whatever you do, just make sure you do these one, two things, what would they be?
First decide, for music students, first decide, why are you choosing to go to school for music? I don't know what camera is, I'm assuming that one. Make that decision. Why are you choosing to go to school for music? Do you want to become a great musician? Or a great writer, or whatever, that's cool.
Yeah.
If you want to do music for a living, you have to tell yourself that, and that means something different. Now you're talking about you want to be in the music business. That's a totally different thing. Music, music business. If you want to be just the best you can possibly be and then let whatever happens from there happen, you know, get first chair in school and fine, that's great. But in the music business, that's something different. And you have to be aware that there is no script for all of that. At the point you make that decision, you have to see yourself as an entity, a brand, an entrepreneur of whatever you do, whether it's being in a big band, whether it's being a composer, whether it's being an artist and going out and doing your own thing, having a band. There is no start date for it. All of a sudden, you are now competing with 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 15-year-olds that are talented. You have to decide what is it that you want to get out of it and then pursue it wholeheartedly. I say once you answer that question, you can get the most out of it. And don't be jaded by my instructor on Tuesdays can't play changes well. Like that, it can be a distraction. The reality is, okay, that may or may not be true, but they might have information that if you sit with them and really get the most out of them might change your life in just discussion or asking them, you know what, I've been working in practice room on this. What do you recommend? They might tell you something in a way that because you're really receptive and you're hungry and you know you're trying to go somewhere with it, you're going to hear it differently. You're going to take it in differently. You're going to study differently. You're going to get rid of the noise differently. And you're not going to let hype all of a sudden getting all the attention in school and everybody in your neighborhood telling you you're dope because you went to school, that's not going to make you feel like the dopest person in your town or village. Just know, decide what it is. What is it you want to do? Answer that question. Do you want to be in the music business? Do music just as a hobby? And either way, stay hungry. Don't get jaded by what other classmates may say about, you know, instructors or who's great or I don't want to do this or why are they teaching me this, or make the most of that, because honestly for me that is what kind of opened up certain paths for me. I never thought really studying the history of jazz and going in and checking out classical music with a certain naiveness would have opened up different concepts for me after school that I was like, man, I'm glad I was paying attention that day and cared that day, and I'm glad, you know, that one teacher that maybe my peers didn't get along with, I actually treated him to lunch one day and got on his good side.
Yeah.
And then that teacher gave me that gig after school. And then that, it's because of him, I ended up meeting such and such and so, you know.
Yeah.
That ended up being a pathway into the music business for me. unknown, you know, in an unknown way, just know, make everything matter, because now you're in a business, and the music business is a people business, school aside. Know that.
Killing, man, yeah. Killing. When you were in school, you started playing with Jill Scott, right?
Yeah.
That's when you first started mm-hmm. playing with her, right? And yep. at some point, did you have to... Like, I've got down here on my notes that you had to choose between finishing college or finishing school.
I did,
and a
yeah.
tour. Like, how did that feel?
Man, that was insane.
Was that a tough decision?
I remember, man. Who is Jill Scott had just come out.
It was huge.
Man, it was huge, man. And she just took off. And I remember my first international gig with her was in London.
Oh,
Jazz
really?
Cafe.
Wow. Yeah.
Jazz Cafe London, I'll never forget, man. And that was so special, man. And London was special to me, too, at that time, because
yeah.
I worked on that Floetry record and all, you know, so it was just cool. It was a cool energy.
Yeah.
But Jill was just so amazing. Her spirit, you know, she was always checking out music, and she was just like one of the guys, except yeah. she wasn't. She was Jill Scott.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love that situation so much, you know, and every musician in the band at the time, you know, we're great friends to this day. It was just so special, and it was so tough at the same time to kind of decide to leave that and go back to school. But you know, when I to answer that other question about, you know, for music students, you know, getting the most out of it, if you trust your path and value taking in information, sometimes you have to make uncomfortable decisions when you don't know how you're going to quite land on your feet yet.
Yeah,
I made that choice to go back to school because all of a sudden I kind of cared differently about the information, you know, I was getting. At that point, I'd made kind of good friends with some of the instructors, and I really started actually working on scores a little bit. And yeah. I was like, you know what, let me just... I was wise enough to know that I didn't know a whole lot.
Yeah, that you felt like you wanted to keep learning.
I didn't know a whole lot, you know, yeah. and I think that was, you know... Really, it was the saving grace for me, man, because I ended up going back to school. And one of the people that helped me make that decision was Jill.
Really?
You know, she said, you know what, follow your heart, because she went to Temple, too,
briefly.
Yeah. And she said, and James Poyser, one of my heroes, he went to Temple, too, you know, and they were all saying,
yeah.
just do it, you know, trust me, just follow your own path, go. And that from that senior year on, that ended up opening a whole new pathway into the business.
Wow.
You know, it was... There where I met Christian McBride, who, my senior year, who connected me, you know, with the summer jazz camps. And from there, you know, things kind of took off. So
yeah, yeah. Similar story, man. Sheree Reed, we were talking with him a couple of months ago. And
Sheree Reed, man. That man.
I know, he's got some, got some groove.
Leave him be. Listen.
He's incredible, isn't it?
I
yeah.
love him.
Yeah. Well, he got the call for Aretha when he was in music school.
Wow.
The first he ended up playing with her later on. But the first call from Aretha Franklin's team. I'm sure it wasn't Aretha on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Sheree.
Right.
I got a call from, I don't even remember who the call was from, but they were like, "Yo, can you can you go out with Aretha?" I'm like, "Oh, Aretha who?" Aretha Jackson,
you know.
No, like, you know, Aretha Franklin. And you know, of course I was like, yeah, but then I was like, you know, I was on scholarship, so I had to, you know, I had to talk to my dad and my teachers, yeah. You know, I asked my teachers and they're like, you know, it's a big opportunity, but you know, they were like, those opportunities they come and go, you know, but like this time to get your education and this experience, you know, it's not going to be around like those other opportunities will. So, yeah. And then my dad's like, man, listen, he's like, that thing will come right back around, man. You just get your education.
The call will come again. And he said, he did come again. He said, amazing. Yeah, yeah.
It seems like, again, you know, looking back when I tell the story, it seems like I'm just telling another fact, but what gets lost in translation, oh no, those moments were big moments. You know, all of a sudden, that Jill Scott, that was also money in the pocket and we're having fun, and all of a sudden to go back to school and, you know, not many gigs. And that's like, when you're that, you know.
Homework.
That's like
every yeah.
But man, you know, again, just trusting the path, or trusting that little voice.
The intuition.
Can't speak to that enough.
When you were in school, and this might have happened before school, and obviously you mentioned that, you know, you were really into gospel earlier on, and then you got into the jazz and, you know, listened to John Patitucci, Jaco, and who was the other guy?
Marcus
Miller, right? Yeah. When it comes to actually sort of getting your fingerboard down and understanding how to move around it and, you know, the things that are available when you're playing, is there any certain exercises or things that you can think about in the past that you discovered that kind of like unlocked little things for you on the bass?
You know, it was a combination. I want to say it was a hybrid of things, man. Because also, again, being influenced by guitar and not letting that go. When I really started trying to develop, how do I manipulate things and make, you know, my voice sing a little bit, you know. I was also trying to get out ideas. I was heavily influenced by, like, vocalists, Nancy Wilson, you know, and Russell Malone, legendary guitarist. Yeah. And some of the things to make things manipulate well on guitar, you know, it's a certain type of stretch for bass.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, you know, not, it was doing less things that were going from the, you know, half first position.
Like, yeah.
It was a lot less of that and more of making sure I was getting clarity and consistency from every finger. So very simple, but
got you.
So for me, because the tendency also in bass is working on ideas that really get extra shifty, you know. Even right there, I've just you know done like four different positions,
and
you know
it's kind
of
moves,
it's kind of designed, you know, when you're reading through early is, you know, just getting you constantly moving up the, you know, up the range. But for me, I decided to not abandon that love of guitar. So I started figuring out how do I kind of group things a little differently too.
So you're looking for systems, basically.
To literally think about more in a more economical way in terms of if I weren't playing bass and I just really wanted to sing and have everything at my, you know, available to me to get to wherever I need to go. And not necessarily think about the way to get to notes that's most comfortable, because sometimes what's least comfortable, just the notes might resonate better on certain strings
to make it work.
Sacrifice of that is sometimes doing unorthodox
move.
So for me, I started grouping things. So the beauty of upright bass, you know, is a certain type of shift where you're really, really kind of aware of, you know, everything behind the instrument.
Yeah, well, one of my questions was going to be, like, when you're playing electric, in your mind, is there a lot of things that are transferring from upright in terms of navigation?
Yeah, for me, upright came in because that movement of, you know, really being aware of specific shifts and grouping and moving that finger around and your thumb being kind of consistent, I decided to use that in kind of shrinking overall general movement. So, you know, if instead of being really comfortable and, you know, thinking being really linear with this, okay, if I bring my thumb in, oh, wow, I discovered if my thumb is right here, you know, it's always a natural shift to the octave. I don't have to see.
Oh, okay.
It's always here.
So you're like leaving that thumb there. So if you're down there, your thumb's actually over here. Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's really unique. Yeah.
And that was a decision for me. And all, so no matter what, it didn't matter the bass. You know, if I'm here, I'm not looking there, but I know this is right here at the octave.
So you can kind of pivot.
Yeah, almost you can on the pivot thumb certain ways. So what you're actually seeing is a lot of just subtle movement here, but it actually is rooted in my thumb is actually being kind of the pivot in a movie.
Yeah, it's kind of kind of static in one point, and then your hand's moving around it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That ended up really informing my decision making. So that actually, you know, kind of really opens up the economy and getting around on the base. So yeah. I'm really thinking it's generally one general. This is all of a sudden, you know, you're now an octave and then a minor. You're two octaves and a minor third on a five string bass. You have of information at your disposal. Yeah. Two octaves. And then that's a whole just in one position.
Yeah.
You know? There was very little, you know,
little
so
movement.
That in so to make that work, that is where upright discipline really helped, because there was a certain callus, my fingers calloused in a certain type of way.
Yeah.
The thing about that and not being as linear, but being more, you know, fluid with it, is that it doesn't just develop calluses. You're going to be using more meat at certain points, you know, so you have to, it won't just be the tip sometimes, other parts of your finger will be developed. So there'll be a season of it hurts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
but the cool thing is, each finger will start to sing, you know, regardless, even if you're having to do an unusual stretch, this callus that might have been developed here is allowing that note to sing where it doesn't sound, even if you're pushing, it doesn't sound sometimes like it'll sound really.
It'll sound strong.
Sing.
Yeah.
It'll sing just as strong, even though it doesn't matter what's going on over there.
Yeah.
And I'm still fluid.
Got you.
It's that same. So I applied that concept, moving around on the bass. So this is the general position when I'm here. I'm not even looking. I already know the octave is always going to be.
So it kind of doubles up again. So you've got that lower position, then you've got the higher position.
It's
yeah,
the octave. So you're never really. It takes a while, you know, to really, because honestly, because every bass is different, you know. So then, not every bass. General scaling is, you know, is a little different. So generally speaking, man, I mean, it's extremely valuable. So my practice became really memorizing what this is and.
And getting the feeling,
going from there,
the physical feel of that into your hand. Because I know that a lot of upright players say that and talk about it. It's the physical feeling.
Yeah.
They can feel where they are positionally just by the feel.
Yeah, yeah. You spend so, I mean, talk about masters, man. John upright, John Petitucci's, Abishai Cohen, another one. The classical bassist, Edgar Meyer, you know, is another one. Of course, Christian McBride.
Yeah.
You know, and the power he gets in the claret, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was a hybrid of, it was also another decision. It was the hybrid of not letting go of figuring out, okay, I asked myself those questions early. You know, we talked about why I went back to school. I was also asked those questions. Okay, go back. Make sure you know what you're going back for. Make it matter.
Yeah, have you a know? Goal in mind instead of just sort of like wandering around.
Yeah,
like,
So aside from the information I wanted to attain, it was also... You know, I wanted to develop, you know, my voice. Also, going into that Jill Scott gig my junior year, I was exposed to some incredible musicians that just kicked my butt.
Yeah.
And I was just like, man, I kind of want to make my instrument sing in a way like that, too. You know, that's pretty cool. Yeah. And that became a true desire, you know. And in that, when I got back to school, it went beyond just trying to improve on the bass in terms of the bass tradition. It was also, okay, how do I manipulate certain things to develop, you know, my voice and my taste. And that was another saving grace where, because I didn't abandon that, that's where certain things I did early, I was able to document it on records, you know, with Terrence Blanchard and
Amazing.
Beyond.
And in terms of harmonically playing around, changing, because some of the stuff you do with Glasper, it's like, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So obviously... And we'll talk about your rhythmical concept as well, because I want to talk that, because that whole thing is a different conversation as well. But in terms of harmonically, is there any way that you organize the notes of the fingerboard? Like, are you thinking scales? Are you thinking chord tones? Are you thinking everything in between?
I actually am not, man.
You're not.
And I'm not. I actually encourage musicians to actually study the piano, get to a piano and actually... learn harmonies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just sit and work on, okay, you know, what is the third? What is the seven? What is a flat third? What is a flat seven? What is a sus? What is a sus nine? What is a plain sus? What exactly is that sound? How is that singing? Why make those choices? You know, sometimes when you sit at piano and just actually really listen to those different densities, and then, okay, not just that, okay, how... not, it's beyond knowing what the chord change is, what's making that chord sound like it is.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people look at lead sheet and they're looking at the chords. I always say, I just need a harmonic sheet, because chords are in is a succession of notes. So that's actually specific. So to me, when I say what's the chord, if somebody says A major 7, to me, that is the harmonic content.
Yeah.
What's the actual chord?
What's the voicing?
Which is the sequence of, and all those things really stand out at piano. So for me, that was another saving grace. I very rarely ever actually worked on harmony on the instrument.
On the instrument, yeah. It should be said as well that, like, some people might be watching this that don't know, but a lot of music schools, piano skills is mandatory, isn't it? When you go, it's like, yeah, you're majoring in whatever, but it's mandatory that you have some basic sort of like piano skills.
I totally recommend
for the exact same reason that you're talking about.
Yeah, I totally recommend that, because if you tend to separate things and just learn harmony for what it is and not necessarily manipulating it at your instrument, but just hear it and see it, you know. But seeing it, you know, sometimes people can hear it and just may not read well. But when you can hear those things, that really opens up another world, because now you're working on your skills as a musician. I recommend, actually, for musicians, if they want to get better at harmony, I'll tell them a list of people to check out. It actually... get your reading chops together and start trying to transcribe note for note what's happening. Get a Billy Childs record and actually try to transcribe it. You know, get something that doesn't have a lot of harmonic movement, like even So What or something like that. Just jot out exactly what you're hearing, or try to mimic exactly every part that you're hearing, and then try to play it together and figure it out. Oh, okay. It's triad movements over while somebody else is doing something else. And it's the combination of things that's making a harmony sound like what it is. But for me, that's what was a saving grace for me. It was like being at piano, really hearing what the harmony is. And then when I'm actually playing, I totally don't. So there is no...
Listening for the harmony.
Exactly.
And then you're applying, you know...
Exactly. Yeah, so...
on the bass.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. Let's put it to test. So... okay, so that's the basic, you know, kind of movement.
Yeah.
But I may just be thinking, literally, okay, how do I make that melody sing and then work backwards in terms of adding harmonic content to it? So... actually, the harmonic information where I'm going backwards, I'm working for,
and then you're hiding,
and letting that inform the harmonic decision making. And instead of thinking from history of the instrument way, instead of type of, you know, block type movement, I'm actually thinking, let me just let my harmonic information I've studied away from the instrument actually just make me completely free where anything can happen. So, right there, it was literally letting the melody in.
So you've got that melody and you're moving through these chords.
Yeah.
How? Because the students will be watching and be like, how's he picking that? How does he come up with all these awesome chords? Are you thinking more piano? Are you just thinking freer in terms of the actual harmonic context?
I'm actually thinking, it's tough to be completely honest though, but I'm actually being completely free. And that's where studying away from the instrument, literally getting away from the instrument and saying, let me just work on the harmony, or maybe no instrument, just transcribe. Because again, I was a terrible reader at first. And you know, Greg Kettinger, who was my oral skills instructor at school, he gave me some valuable information. He said, you know what, while you're trying to develop that skill set, man, find ways to stay engaged, because that's a skill set, reading and writing. Yeah, you know, you got to just do it, you know?
Yeah.
So start with doing things that you like. Figure out, listen to music that you like, and actually always have a pen and paper by you and just start trying to jot it out.
Yeah, get into a habit of it.
That got my pen game up a little bit, you know, a little bit better. So then when I was able to get to a piano or even a guitar or something and work out harmonies, now I'm able to also jot it down, but I'm able to hear it beyond an actual instrument. So oftentimes I play the bass, you know, because I enjoy it, but in reality, harmonic movement and things like that, or how I'm singing, you know, in any given moment, it's literally letting it all go.
But in my opinion,
one of the only ways to, I would say, get to that is really just checking out harmony, and I recommend doing it away from the instrument.
Absolutely.
Away from the instrument that you play.
Yeah. Because if you're doing it with the instrument, you'd fall into all of the old stuff that you just, you know, that you rely on, right?
Yeah.
So if you get rid of that.
Yeah. And then, you know, some people just have a natural voice on that instrument that transcends, you know, that, and however you get to it, you get to. But for me, it was that thing of just really checking things out and also understanding, oh, wait, now that I'm actually trying to transcribe, why is it that when I know the harmony and I voice it out on piano, why does it sound different than what I'm seeing on the score?
And then
that gets into a whole other thing with densities. So that's where it becomes very important, because if you come out with the coolest sequence of notes possible, that might sound the dopest on that specific instrument that you're playing, but then when you translate that to an orchestra,
completely different.
Yeah, it might be the bowings,
yeah,
and the bow markings that's making it seem and sound like it. So I challenge people to actually just start checking out and be willing to start transcribing on the earlier side.
Yeah,
that's invaluable, away from the instrument.
Yeah. Be able to do it away from the instrument.
Yeah,
your rhythmical concept.
Yep,
Chris Dave, you. Right, so when you first started playing, where was Chris Davis playing when you started playing with him? Because when I listen to you guys, obviously Chris has got this really, really mature, and he was one of the first guys to really start playing with that, what's been kind of labelled with that, either that Dilla beat type thing or that drunk feel where it's sort of like weird and swung and exactly sure. You know, like a lot of my really great drumming friends that are, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but really, you know, they're A-listers. They're listening to, they're like, how are these guys doing that? Like,
they're trying to do it.
And they're just like, I just can't do it. When you started playing with Chris, did he have that stuff nailed down?
Chris?
Out the gate.
Chris, Daddy Dave, as they call him, he's just a freak of nature. He had that stuff down. He always had that. I mean, even before I was playing with him, man, I mean, even going back, I can't recall a time where he didn't have that intentional approach of being his self unapologetically.
Yeah.
You know, so when I was honored to play with him, man, the very first time at the 55 bar, which is documented, actually.
Really? Is it on YouTube?
The bootleg is documented. Wow. That was circulating forever, man. I actually got to find it now.
Was it you, Chris Dave, Robert Glasper?
Yep. And I think Roy Hargrove came through that night, too. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
But he always had that thing about him. But one thing that's kind of interesting, Chris really listens, man. And it wasn't until we actually sat down and played together, and I was just like, oh man, he's listening to every, I'll never forget, there was a song we played 55 bars, our first time playing, and Rob started singing it to us, and we started, I forgot that song, So That's all I was playing.
Yeah.
So the style of me playing that, normally, if it's kind of laid back, a drummer will start like over.
Overly
marking a genre or a sound, you know?
Yeah.
What was cool with Chris is like how he would sneak in and really like pay attention to not just the notes I'm playing, like the detail, like certain notes I might be playing harder, you know, like he was aware of that.
Right. And okay,
that
was feel the, like, yeah.
So.
Yeah. He's like,
it was
putting things in the gaps and stuff.
Yeah, and it was so weird because like that, he was probably one of the first drummers. No, he was without question the first drummer. We're playing. I'm sitting here. My foot is keeping his bass drum from like sliding. The whole night he's staring at my finger. Like,
oh, really?
He just and enjoy like his awareness, man. Yeah, like not just to. The obvious thing like choice of notes and stuff, his awareness to pressure and decision, you know, all that stuff, and when anticipating what I may do the next, I'm like, how did you know I was gonna, that side of Chris Dave is just unbelievable. So yeah. It's no surprise he's also one of the most he's one of the best listeners and can manipulate so many different styles because people hear the brave heart that he is and the unapologetic
and he can he manipulates that beat like nobody. It's like almost elastic.
But what stuck with me when I first started playing with him was his awareness of so many elements, you know. It's no different. His sensitivity was no different than how Kendrick Scott would be on a ride cymbal or something like that. You know, listening to Blade with somebody, it was just like, you know, the aesthetics are a little different how he's playing, but man, his awareness is totally cool. So I try to honor that in return since I know he's always aware.
Mm.
You know, with him, it's been so much fun just from the beginning. It's always been this just a respect of awareness.
Yeah.
Like we never have to, he never has to be like, you know, if we're that same night we're doing. He wanted to break from that. It was never it was just, he could tell, you know, he could tell that I actually enjoyed the bass line. Not trying to prove a point, the bass player, he could tell I enjoyed that.
Like, yeah.
And he's that type of guy that's really hearing every part of the inflection that I'm not just playing. Knows.
He's saving everything,
And he doesn't he's the type that won't overly mark what I'm doing. It wouldn't be a So because of
Hey Derek, I know what you're doing. Hey Derek, check me.
So because of that, like that, the fact that somebody appreciates rhythmically what you're doing makes you want to honor that, and I think that's one of the biggest things in our relationship. So now he, like, we'll just be vibing and he will go into a whole, I'll start the bass line and then he'll just start a whole other. And he'll just.
Yeah.
A whole other. But meanwhile, like, one thing might be an inflection based off of what.
Of something, a downbeat or an upbeat of what you're playing.
Yeah,
and it's locking in somewhere.
It's so crazy, man. So that trust and acceptance, and also, you know, like for example, in that situation, Robert's just listening and just doing this thing, and then you know, so it's the multifaceted conversations, you know, that make the rhythmic thing come across so, I want to say convincing, but convincing in that situation. So my thing is, it's decision making when it comes, rhythmically it depends, because when I'm playing jazz and swinging, you know, specifically, the elasticity of it is what, in my opinion, is what makes, part of what makes it so beautiful.
Yeah, well, I was that elasticity, yeah. Like, what do you do when he's playing really super elastic and he's maybe like his rhythmical grid? Don't know how people talk about that rhythmical grid. Sometimes when I'm listening to that, I'm like, oh, it's the rhythmical grid is actually like flexing almost, right? What do you do? Do you try and flex with him or?
It's decision making. So,
or do you try and just
playing? Yeah, it's decision making because knowing. I say there's good time, you know, and then there's just time awareness. You know, I'll never forget when I first started playing jazz, Rodney Green, great drummer. You know, Rodney said, man, you know, you play too much like a metronome. Your time's too good. And I was like, man, what? He's like, you play too, you know, he's like, it's the relationship. It's the relationship that makes it where it's like listening to all those things and the aesthetics of how that's working in each thing that gives the illusion sometimes of great time.
Yeah.
You know, but it might just be how one person is seeming consistent.
Yeah.
And so then it was just like, man, okay, when I'm playing in the straight ahead sense, sometimes what might seem like good time might be me pulling back because I'm hearing a drummer rush or not rush, but push.
Yeah. But and you need that sort of like that friction almost,
But sometimes in another situation, I might go with that drummer because the pianist might have a tendency to lay back a little too much.
To sit back in the pocket,
So going into anything with a certain rule kind of overly marks like my style and makes my ears kind of shut off a certain type of way. So one of the biggest things for me, you know, checking out jazz and, you know, for people, listen, I really recommend, I mean, there's obvious... yin and yangs like Ron Carter you know, and Tony Williams to check out. But even something, man, like Israel Crosby.
Yeah.
Even listening to him, I mean, on the stuff, he's so solid and playing so hard. But actually, you know, he influenced Ron Carter.
Yeah.
But when you listen to Israel Crosby, you know, like, actually, it's some of the triplets in there, it's not exact. It's that combination of things mixed with a drummer in that situation and Ed Thigpen, who's really keeping the time really strict, you know, like that makes that work.
Versus
somebody he might have influenced, like Ron Carter. Ron Carter, you know, has a certain spirit in his choices of notes that remind me of Israel Crosby, even though Ron's doing his own thing. But rhythmically, I don't hear that at all.
It's completely different.
You hear him with it's like, that's the beauty of like, oh man, okay, interpretation, elasticity, and all those things, like figuring out what that is. And so when it comes back, circling back around to Chris, working with somebody that's very aware of that, but then trusting that he can switch personalities in any given moment and trusting that I'll stay there. That's what makes that so beautiful. Because it's rare where if I just choose to go, nine times out of ten, the drummer will start and do something that all of a sudden now we're just stylistically going. But Chris will hear that and then just trust that I have. Because the cool thing, the thing is, I'm tapping right now for clarity.
Yeah.
But in the moment, I'm not. He stopped playing, and it's just me. He trusts that I'm not lost. He's trust.
Yeah. There's a lot of trust, isn't there?
There's a lot of trust, man. You know. So, for me, that's where I think like practice in shedding different interpretations of what good rhythm is cool.
Yeah.
Like for me, I was also in Latin bands. You know, in college, and believe it or not, that was one of the biggest influence in terms of rhythm.
What, rhythm,
and awareness, yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah. Just being in local Latin bands, man. Yeah. And where, in that case, if the bass player is not being like the rock, and there's a lot of freedom too.
Yeah.
You know, in that music, you know. But if the bass player is not aware of the his importance in that band, because yeah. people are dancing to it, and all yeah, kind of things that happen. Yeah. Like, so in that case, it's rhythmic responsibility too. Yeah. You know, it's like different ways of thinking about rhythm's place, and not necessarily thinking what I'm doing, good rhythm, it being just being solid. You know, yeah. it comes back to, honestly, my same approach in harmony.
Mm.
Like, sometimes listening to mute, working on it away from the music.
Yeah, yeah.
And playing different styles of music. So, for example, when I would play gospel music where it's like a lot more rigid beat, that metronome era style, you know, for me, yeah. that really comes in harmony. Yeah. I mean, it comes in, you know, it really comes, it's valuable.
Yeah.
But being aware that that's not the end all be all to what is great, you know, and being able to get away from that and do something like that and actually apply that to even the classical world too. Like, it's just being aware that actual rhythmic awareness is probably more valuable than anything, you know?
Yeah,
and actually, I feel like a peer of mine, believe it or not, he doesn't get enough credit for that. Michael League?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like in his
music, absolutely,
I checked him out a lot, but when I listen to that, there are some subtleties that's happening, man. You know, aside from drums and movement, what's making some of the shifts and swells without him overly trying to do it from the bass is actually his band leading from the instrument. You can slightly hear it.
Absolutely.
And that rhythmic awareness, you know what I mean? And the swells and kind of intent, you hear it in certain type of ways. And also sometimes the deception of getting stronger in rhythm, but it might just be all of a sudden making the notes more marked.
Yeah.
So
he said something like a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Something like that would lead into something, but how everybody knew that was coming might be from, oh, okay, I'm hearing more enunciation now.
Yeah, exactly. He said something a few weeks ago, and it really made me think. I've not heard anybody, and I think it kind of like wraps around what we're talking about right now. He said, good time and good groove are two completely different things. He said, you can have
that
good time.
That is true.
He said, you can have great time and not groove. And you can really groove and not have good time as well. He said, they're two separate things. I was like,
that is it.
No.
What I was talking about is time.
Yeah.
When I'm talking about doing these exercises, I'm talking about time, about locking in with a metronome and really having a clear sense of how to play in time.
Yeah.
Groove and feel is a completely different thing. People can have groove and feel without having good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Many people have good time
and don't have
groove or feel. You know, these things are very different.
That's what I'm getting. I completely concur with that.
Yeah.
And being aware of that, because sometimes a situation might require focusing on good time and maybe sacrificing a little groove for the sake of.
And when you were saying like you're playing too, it's too much, it's too metronomic.
Yeah.
Right? It kind of sort of like feeds into that as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely, man. Yeah. I mean, so honestly, checking out different genres of and what defines great time based on certain styles and also certain relationships between some of your favorite players on records.
Yeah.
Could be different, you know? So really, it comes back, I can't say it enough, listening.
Yeah. You just mentioned the classical thing as well. I can't let you go anywhere without talking about, like, obviously you've got this whole thing, you know, you like started playing with Jill Scott, but then you've been sort of like musical director for Maxwell, and then like you've played with a myriad of different artists.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got the whole jazz thing going on as well. But you've got this whole symphony thing happening and film music, I'm honored. What's going on?
Yeah.
Was that a natural progression with your career right through until now? Or was there a moment where that started to take off?
You know, I got to tell you, man, Scott, to be honest with you, my whole career, and I feel very fortunate to say, has really been things that have blossomed based off of actually what I enjoy, you know? And the path wasn't necessarily clear at first, but it was honestly just sticking to what I enjoyed, whether it was hobby or bugging people. You know, and yeah, that has its place too. Yeah. You know, again, asking yourself, do you want to do music or music business and all that? It's a people business, like I said earlier. That all relates. Mm. And I didn't know at that time how that was all going to work out for me. I didn't know that, you know, going to the library and studying scores would drive me to start actually writing my own scores and sending it to guys to just look at who didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
Or that would lead to other musicians knowing that I was doing that. I brought up Rodney Green. He mentioned me to Terrence Blanchard. He said, hey, man, this guy, he also writes and all this stuff. And I really feel like, who would have known another peer had recommended, would have connected me from seeing me doing hustle plays around the way in Philly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You never know how that's going to work out for you. So for me, it was that continuing to try to develop, even when it didn't seem like the pathway was set for me. Checking out scores in school, bugging my professors, even in college, until they put me in orchestra, you know, until I, you know, the composition teacher just pulled me aside and we started studying together. And that is what, you know, essentially I got into Sundance, which was really great, you know. Mm. And once you get in there and you're known as a composer now, that kind of changes things too.
Oh, yeah.
Because that led to me getting my first commission with the
it's
Chicago
Symphony. It's like a killing business card.
That led me to getting my first commission with the Chicago Symphony. And that opens up opportunities because all of a sudden, you're seen a certain type of way.
Yeah.
So in terms of opportunities, they just started coming my way, you know. Wow. Working with Nas in the Kennedy Center, for that Illmatic piece, that was really special because to now do something that resonates with me across the spectrum, it's, again, because I try not to separate the worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to get a chance to orchestrate for a symphony orchestra where historically, you know, those are, it was the first hip-hop performance that historically those, you know, doors were closed. So to be part of that history and be able to write for them what I feel is our story culturally.
Yeah.
That was life changing for me. It went beyond just now talking about resume and trying to name drop.
Yeah.
It was, now it's like, oh shoot, that opportunity allowed me to have a voice to do more of that.
Yeah.
So now that's why that led to, you know, I'm not doing with Common. I'm working with Maxwell for another Kennedy Center piece actually this fall. And I'm trying to do that as much as possible, you know, now try to document what I feel like is our story of our own storytellers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's been a complete blessing, but in reality, it was hustle plays when nobody was paying attention.
And it just blossomed in various,
Man, that's the one thing, man, you never know. But in hindsight, that's why I tell people, again, you know, if students are watching, don't just see yourself as a student, like see yourself as a personality that if you're going to do anything in a music business, you're talking about working with people. Yeah. Whether it's your actual album, they're going to have to fall in love with something. Whether it's your personality on stage, you know, that's going to make them support and come.
Yeah,
Whether it's your personality on recordings, that's going to make them support. Whether it's your personality with the artist that now wants you attached to anything that they're doing, that's still people business.
Yeah, yeah,
you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, don't underestimate that. For me, it was checking things out and also turning things down to create space to get better. Who would have known that me going broke, not doing gigs anymore, would have led to other opportunities?
Yeah.
Had I chose to, just for me personally, chose to stay doing Jill, you know, I know it would have been a fun journey, but I know for a fact that the unique journey in terms of timing of relationships wouldn't have happened the way it did for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Have
you got, have you ever had opportunities now that you're having to push away? Because obviously you're really busy. You're really busy.
You know,
is that tough sometimes?
Yeah, for me, it's fun. I really honored, man, for the calls that come and to this day. But I, honestly, with that, I've gotten more joy. And I mean, my best friends, Adam Blackstone, those guys will tell you, you know, who's in the world actually hiring a lot of people for these bands. I get more joy in recommending guys
Got you.
For gigs now. And, you know, making sure if there's somebody hungry that just needs somebody to pay attention, if they do the work, at least they'll get a shot. Whether it's a, you know, like, because in reality, you know, people don't have to even care about music and musicians anymore. It's, you know, it's not as prevalent in schools anymore in the U.S., unfortunately. So I feel a responsibility to be part of, in any way, pushing it forward, making sure people shine and trying to get all the gigs. That's, for me, that's not the answer. Think, again, going back to my peers being a heavy influence on the way I think, I grew up like that. You know, with your best friends, you know, from Thaddeus to Wayne and Adam being bass players, they're they're playing the same instrument as you. You know, we have similar dreams and all that. So, but we, from day one, we cared about what each other were doing, you know, and wanted everybody to shine. And I think that is what's kind of led to my career path as a bassist now, doing less in terms of playing with a whole bunch of different people, but just seeing a lot of bassists take those opportunities that I might recommend them for and shine. That's, I feel like that's part of my story too.
Hear, hear, man. Yeah. I can't let you go without talking about bass gear.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll be burned in flame. Him go. You had him and you let him go without talking about basses. What is this? It looks amazing. How do you pronounce it?
This is a Miura bass.
Miura. Man. And this guy used to make the...
What is that?
Exotic.
Exotic.
He was the guy that started Exotic, right? And then he's left, obviously, and he started this new bass company.
Yeah.
Like, how did that relation develop? And how did, like, did you have any... anything to do with the development of this bass? Were you like, this is the bass I want. I want this, that, that. Or was it like he was just like, check this out. And you were like, I'm sold. Give me it.
Man, this is what I'm very glad you asked that, actually. For me, I didn't play like fancy basses, man, growing up, or boutique basses, or you had that luxury, man. And
you had the jazz bass, that five string, yeah?
Yeah, I had a PV Dyna bass.
Nice. I played a PV Dyna bass
all the way, and I remember I didn't have any money, and that bass that I was playing, right, that Fender, that red Fender, I bought used in Philly.
Really? Yeah.
At this music store, and I didn't have enough money. They said, just give me $450 for it, man. And I bought the bass. And pickups were.
And you played it for years, right? Didn't you?
Yeah. So I got that bass. It was kind of shabby when I actually bought it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I went to school with Tim Clunan, you know, who made Tallow Hill basses. Yeah. He was a student at my. He took my bass and
made it nice up. Again.
Put me on a Nordstrand pickup and it cleaned it up. And but for me, I've never, like, you know, I'm thankful guys have offered to make basses. I'm not that guy even chasing endorsements.
You're not the guy chasing endorsements.
I'll buy a bass, you know, like, I'm just that person, man. So it's very rare that, you know, if it's a really kind of upscale bass that I'll gravitate to it.
Yeah.
But Miura was different because I was in L.A. We were getting ready for the R plus R equals Now record with, you know, Robert Glasper, Terrence Martin, Christian Scott, and Justin Tyson, a few other guys. And the whole thing is about, you know, reflect, respond equals now. And, you know, I'm kind of honored because they chose that name. You know, Robert talked about Nina Simone being, you know, in the times. And we were doing a record. And I was laying a bass track, and in the moment, I was just saying, man, I'm just trying to respond, man, whatever. And they kept that, you know, ended up making that the name R plus R equals Now, Reflect and Respond equals Now. So when I knew that record date was coming up, I said, let me do something unique. You know, let me try playing a bass I've never played.
Oh, really? Before. Yeah. That's where it was born from, yeah.
I went in the music store. I had a couple days off in L.A. for that record date. For another record date, and I went into a music store, Bass Exchange in L.A., and just introduced myself to the guys at the counter, and they just kept handing me different basses just to check out, told me a little bit about it. And Miura was the first bass that I played. And then I checked out a bunch of other ones after, and I was like, I think I want to try this, you know? So I just sent him a message on social media saying, hey, just checked out your bass. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'll be back in a week. Hope to, you know, check it out again. Man, he ended up getting the address to the studio, showed up with a few really, of the basses.
Yeah. Amazing.
And I ended up, man, I had the Fender tuned up and everything ready to go. And I said, well, man, this is Reflect Respond now. Why don't we do something different?
Yeah.
I picked up the bass, tuned it up, man. And then every song you're hearing on that album is me. I'm playing it for the first time.
Yeah.
It's one of the two. Yeah.
Wow, like,
I can't even really remember awesome. Which basses I was even playing.
On which song? Yeah,
I just, because he had three, and I just was like, let me just try it out. And I wanted to document something unique. And I showed him love after that. And from there, he ended up making this instrument, which is actually, this is actually his standard instrument that he makes. I didn't want anything custom. And we're still arguing to this day. I'm like, this makes me happy, man.
Yeah.
I don't want. Why waste your money building? I'm happy, man. I'm good.
This one's perfect.
I'll support you, man. Shout out. I feel like that's what it should be about.
So,
I've been rocking Miuras ever since, about a year and a half, and it's been fun, man.
Yeah, it's absolutely awesome. And it's just one pickup on this one, right?
Yeah, it's Delano. Yeah. Delano pickup.
And why is it like a crazy shape? Is there anything sort of like magical happening in there?
It's a big cap. It's actually two pickups in here.
Got you.
But yeah, it's the positioning of it was based on, I think, from what they told me from the earlier Music Man's.
Got you.
But because of these type of pickups, the back ones, man, they're really, really responsive, man. So even though it can be meaty, man, it tends to cut in a very focused way.
Yeah.
You know, which I kind of dig, and it doesn't sound too
bridge
pickup.
Yeah. Sort of like quacky.
Exactly.
Thing.
You can get a lot of meat and body out of it. You know, a lot of recent records that I've done, people would never know that it was this instrument.
Right.
They think it's, you know, because at home I record on a lot of, you know, a couple different Fenders that I have, you know.
Yeah.
But I've been using this lately and it tracks great.
Sounds killing, man. Sounds killing, man. Dude, have I missed anything? Is there anything you're going to walk out and you're thinking, Scott, you didn't ask me this question?
Man.
What is it? Maybe I'm just a good interviewer and I've got everything. I don't know.
I feel like I've been running my mouth. I hope I have some good stuff, man.
If people want to find out what you're doing next and stuff like that, have you got a website or where should we send them?
Man, got a lot of cool things in the works, man. And for everything Derek Hodge related, just DerekHodge.com.
Yeah.
You can check out everything there. I'm really excited, man. I'm going to be posting even more, man, about different writing opportunities. You know, I have this concept, Color of Noise, that I'm really getting off the ground now. Don't want to talk too much about it yet, but follow that journey, DerekHodge.com, and on my different social media platforms, on Instagram, D Hodge World, Twitter, and Facebook, just Derek Hodge, official Derek Hodge. Just go on this journey with me, man.
Amazing. Thank you so much, man. It's been an absolute honor meeting you.
Are you kidding me? Other way around.
Cheers.
Yeah, man.
Thanks, guys.